Turning this evening to the book of Daniel, chapter 7 and verse 1. Daniel, chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. And our subject is the momentous vision. And this vision occurs, we read, in the first year of Belshazzar. So it's just a little while before 539 BC, the fall of Babylon, the 70 years of captivity in Babylon are coming to an end. And at such a time, the Lord is going to reveal to Daniel how long is to go before Messiah comes, and some of the great things of history that will be unfolded. Now, this is the last chapter of the book, of the Aramaic section of the book, and it is a vision in chapter 7, which runs parallel with that in chapter 2. Well, that was a dream to Nebuchadnezzar, which Daniel was given to interpret. And you remember the four world empires. And this chapter, this vision, runs parallel, but it gives rather more information. And it's most important, really, that the people of God, the remnant of faithful people, should have such instruction. And so it's given to Daniel, that they shall wait patiently through, well, they didn't know the time that they had to wait, but they knew how long empires lasted. And if they were in the first of four, and there were three to go, well, they realized that Messiah was some way off. And yet the vision that Daniel is given is full of encouragement and certainty, and showing the power of God to surely bring about his purposes, and to lay first one, then the next, then the next, then the next empire aside. But there's more than that in this chapter, and we'll look at as much of it as we can. I'm not going to divide into headings. I'm going to go through at speed in a simple expository manner so that we get an overview and everything that's here. Now, the image that was given to Nebuchadnezzar in his dream was human. And the four world empires were part of a human image or structure. But now the imagery changes, because there will be four beasts, and one so terrible that an animal ferocious enough isn't to hand to depict the fourth of the empires. So whereas there was a human side given to the history of four empires in chapter 2, now you see the fallen side and the vicious side, where beasts come in to illustrate the very same empires. But let's proceed through these verses. In verse 1, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head. There's a kind of double description. It's not just a dream. They're visions clearly imparted by God upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream. Why would he do that? Well, under inspiration and urging by the Lord, but he realized that this wasn't just for him. This was something of tremendous importance that was to be learned and known by the true people of God, to encourage them down the centuries, and then afterwards also. And he told the sum of the matters, and our translation is perhaps a little too general. The idea is that he told everything except the very secondary matters that were seen in this very vivid, long vision. And in verse 2, Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven. And that possibly suggests that while the beasts that arise from the earth are going to be themselves responsible for their viciousness and their murder, Yet God superintends all. You imagine human beings, fallen human beings, only too ready to war, only too ready to follow territorial aggression, a seething mass of humanity, aggressive in its intent, and yet there are powers that limit some nations and yet permit others to do what's in their mind, in their heart. So the dream shows here in verse 2, the four winds of the heaven, a shadowy way of showing the superintendency of God, one would think, striving upon the great sea. The great sea is humanity, the nations. It is throughout the Old Testament, internationalism, the countries. So here is God restraining and permitting the activities of nations according to his plan. And in detail, in verse 3, four great beasts came up from the sea. As you go on, and through this chapter and later chapters, you realize that these four beasts did not actually arise simultaneously. They follow one another. Four great beasts came up from humanity, diverse one from another. They're going to be precisely the same four empires that we were introduced to in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. And then they're described. Verse 4, the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Well, that's the empire that Daniel is part of at that very time. That's Babylon, which had assimilated the Assyrian Empire and taken it under itself. And here it is, Nimrod has given way and to Nineveh to Babylon, and now it is the empire of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, and depicted as a lion with eagle's wings. That's just how that empire, which was the current empire in which Daniel served, that's just how it depicted itself. And you know well, and you've possibly seen them in the British Museum, that the royal palaces had the great lion figures with eagle's wings. So it's not very difficult to interpret this. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Yes, the ferocity and the conquering spirit of a lion and the mobility and, system of insight which would be suggested by a great bird. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and Babylon came to an end. Hadn't happened yet at the time that Daniel received the vision, but shortly would. And it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, which may be reflecting just exactly what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, and we've read about that too, and how he was made mad and behaved as a beast to humble him. And that coincided with the period when the Babylonian Empire stopped being a great conquering force, left off conquest, and became rather more civil. And perhaps it reflects that. So it was humanized, in a sense, towards the end of its period. And that was a weakness and enabled the rise of the Persian empire to take it over. Well, here it is, lifted up from the earth, made stand upon the feet of a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, verse 5, a second, like to a bear, not as ferocious as a lion, but almost, not as grand, not as imperial, you might think. Well, this is going to be the empire that followed, the Persian Empire. And, Median Persian Empire, but the Median part of it was the smaller part. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, for which there are many attempted explanations, but The one I rather take to is the idea that this creature, this beast, was poised to leap forward, that it's a posture of aggression rather than anything else. And it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. The aggressive Persian Empire, which grew bigger than the Babylonian Empire. And verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, or some would translate panther, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. This is the empire of Greece. This is Alexander the Great. Four wings of a fowl, not two, four. In other words, rapidity and mobility. And it was so, as you know, that Alexander the Great achieved all his conquests in a very short time, as a very young man. And so it was a rapid conquest. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it, which suggests that God permitted the rise of that empire in order to punish the nations. It was, in fact, fragmented and then ultimately divided into four parts with four generals acting as king of each and in rivalry one to another. That is just how it turned out. But to verse 7, after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. Now no animal is used to describe this one. A fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. Well, you know, the Roman Empire that followed the empire of the Greeks. Well, it was depicted in Nebuchadnezzar's dream as being of iron, and how iron comes back here, iron teeth, it devoured and break in pieces. And yes, that was, everyone agrees, a characteristic of Rome. Not to, rather as the Babylonians did, try to police and rule the regions by nationals, take them to Babylon as captives, as Daniel was taken, train them in the ways of the Babylonians, post them back home to administer the regions. There, no, nothing like that with Rome. Rome just broke and smashed anything in its path and stamped the residue with the feet of it. It was arguably the most brutal of all. And it was diverse, end of verse 7, from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now those 10 horns attract particular scrutiny from Daniel in his vision. And he says so in verse 8, I considered the horns. I intently gazed at the horns and studied them in the vision. The vision, to some extent, is interactive in this way. And behold, there came up among them another little horn, and then something very strange, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. Doesn't say how it happened, doesn't say that the little horn did this and achieved this, or who did it for him or how, because those things are not necessary, really, not too much detail. It's just the meaning of it, which is going to be important. So three horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this little horn, which was quite different from the others, were eyes like the eyes of a man, capable of scrutiny, and a mouth speaking great things, proud things, bombastic things, boastful things, is the idea behind the words. So this is of particular interest. What might the 10 horns be that are described here? Well, before we proceed to verse 9, I just take you on down the verses to verse 20, and we'll look at this in advance. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout, more lordly, greater, more self-assured, more boastful than his fellows. Verse 21, I beheld, and that the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came. So we just go forward there to verse 20 to realise that the little horn is going to be Antichrist or some violently anti-Christian force or movement or person. That's enough for the moment. We go back to where we left off. Verse 8 then, Daniel considers the horns, the little horn, but what were the other ones? Well, it's not easy to be certain about the others. Calvin insisted that they were just the regional governors of the Empire of Rome. But others would assign them to various kings that followed Rome. But a more general view is that they represent, after the fall of Rome, just kingdoms in general. Because 10 is a perfect number in Old Testament prophecy. And so we're not called to be specific. There's no detailed description of them. So after Rome is a period of nation states and governments and kings, and probably they refer to that. But among them and from them, there's a particularly virulent anti-Christian power and force at work. That's just enough for the moment. And we come to verse 9. I beheld till the thrones were cast down. Now the original could read either the thrones were set or they were cast down. Our King James translators have chosen cast down, which suggests to us that the throne and the Ancient of Days came when the four beasts were defeated. But it's equally likely that it should read, I beheld till the thrones were set. A courtroom is now being described. One of the occupants of the throne is going to be the Ancient of Days. Other thrones, well, we're not told who occupies them. Perhaps it may be the Son of Man, who's introduced shortly. Perhaps it may be the cherubim of justice. They're not mentioned with regard to an occupant. But anyway, it's a courtroom more likely that's being described. I peered and looked until thrones were set down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, the purity of God, God the Father, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His age is wisdom. Of course, God cannot be seen by Daniel. He can only be represented in a vision in this way. His throne was like the fiery flame, the flame of judgment. His wheels, this throne is rather like a chariot, and it's going to depict the wisdom of God. He can proceed anywhere. Verse 10, a fiery stream issued, which may be a description of the angelic host which follow, or it may be alongside the angelic host, depicting the invincibility of God acting in judgment. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Then you read about the thousands ministering unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. It's a tremendous scene, overwhelming for Daniel in the vision. The judgment was set, and the books were opened, the books of all human deeds and the names of people. And verse 11, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. So this virulent anti-Christian voice, this one who speaks great swelling words and is so proud, well, he's berating the faith and Christians, the Lord and his word, right up until the time of judgment, to the very end. In fact, his voice is louder as you draw to the end. Verse 11, halfway, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. Does that mean that the beast, the Roman Empire, will last until the judgment day? No, it doesn't. It's just the account is somewhat telescoped in this verse. It's drawn out again as we proceed further on. It means that all these empires will fall in their day, but their judgment, of course, and their final end, is reserved until the day of judgment. Verse 12, as concerning the rest of the beasts, the other three, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Or, as more modern translations render it, for a time and times and half a time, which of course reminds you of the book of Revelation. So these beasts fall, one replaces the other, but the nations that were empires continue to exist. Their dominion is removed, their glory taken away, but they don't vanish. Well, that's exactly as it is. And then verse 13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, just as we're told in the Gospels, Christ will come, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Now this son, one described as the Son of Man, as we go on, is clearly divine. Verse 14, and there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom. This is really after the time of judgment, when Christ has complete dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations and languages, save Jews, save Gentiles, should serve him. This is a picture of the eternal hereafter, not a mere millennium. This is something which lasts forever. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. Now, just at this point, we need to remind ourselves that in the prophecies of the Old Testament that talk about the end of the world or future things, there is never a distinction made between Christ's first coming and his second coming. You must always remember that principle. Old Testament prophecy, Daniel comes pretty near it in some of the later visions, but it isn't absolutely clear. Old Testament prophecy sees Christ coming and his kingdom and his glory. It does not go into detail, not in the Old Testament period, and explain that he comes, he's incarnate, he walks on earth, he suffers and dies, he's raised from the dead, he ascends into heaven. And then there is a long period, the age of the gospel, the age of the Gentiles, in which the Christian church is established and flourishes through the world, and many, many people are converted, and then Christ comes again in power and glory to judge the living and the dead, and the earth is destroyed and reconstituted marvelously and made spiritual and heavenly and somehow united with heaven for the occupation of the people of God for all eternity. That entire New Testament age with its two comings, Christ at the beginning, coming again at the end, that is seen as one appearance of Christ in Old Testament prophecy. So when you read this seventh chapter of Daniel, you look in vain for the two appearances of Christ. You see hints of it, which, dare I say, I don't suppose Daniel understood with his Old Testament light. Continually in his prophecies, he tells us how little he understands about them. But the hints are there, but it isn't clearly seen. So don't be confused at all. The Old Testament prophets are only called to prophesy the coming of Christ. There are some indications, but it isn't absolutely clear to them that there will in fact be two comings. And that's left to the New Testament to bring in the detail. Well, now I proceed, and verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by. I'm pretty sure it's an angel. That's the only other being that's been mentioned. And asked him the truth of all this, the meaning. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. And then there's explanation from verse 17. These great beasts, which are four kings. And Daniel is only too familiar with one of them, the Babylonian Empire, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High, note the word saints, that's very interesting. Here in the Old Testament, the saints of the Most High. The saints are the set apart ones. Those who are set apart from the world, from the godless world, the polytheistic world, should be set apart today too. One of our greatest dangers is that even Bible-believing Christians, there are so many threads and movements among us which are joining with the world. The saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom. Well, yes, but not until the second coming of Christ. And possess the kingdom is referring to the whole world, as it has in the earlier verse that I read, and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever, uninterrupted, eternal, perfect bliss with Christ reigning. But you see, Daniel's vision takes him over the details to put both comings of Christ together and to go right to the end. Verse 19, then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass. We didn't read that before. Nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, crushed all opposition. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, the little horn, before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes, scrutiny, and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more lordly, imperial, and proud than his fellows. What about this little horn, the Antichrist? It comes up at the time of the Roman Empire. With the Roman Empire comes the kingdom of Christ. Christ comes, and with the founding of the church comes Antichrist. There are many antichrists, says the Apostle John in his first epistle. Antichrists are here now, already, not just at the end of the present gospel age, he says, but even now. Pride is the great feature of Antichrist. And I read it before, verse 21, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them until the final day of judgment. Well, that's exactly what has happened. The spiritual warfare, the antagonism of Satan towards the proclamation of the word and the Church of Christ. It's come in different forms, but it's a little horn. Is that appropriate? You would think that if Rome was such a beast, that no animal is adequate to describe it. And if there are 10 fierce horns arise from Rome, when Rome collapses, nation states take over, but they all operate in a similar vein. They're not world empires, but they're all conquering and aggressive groups. If these take over, why is the Antichrist a little horn? Well, probably because Antichrist doesn't manifest itself in military power, in physical might and strength. It isn't powerful, rather, like the conquering nations or empires were. Words are its main tool. Antichrist is operating with cunning, with teaching, contradicting, tearing down truth. Words are our great enemy. The Antichrist, yes, we do have violence against us. Satan does inspire violence from time to time and in different parts of the world. But words are the key thing. So in the early centuries, for instance, you see the rise of the Church of Rome, where Satan's, Antichrist's, chosen channel to oppose the church was doctrinal. So justification by works is promoted. And the grand authority of clergy and a new priesthood, all claiming authority over souls, an authority to devise doctrine and ceremonies and taking people away from the pure gospel and persecuting those who proclaim it. But the dangerous part of it was the contradiction of the gracious doctrine of the New Testament. And then as time goes on, you get the enlightenment and reason and human reason is exalted above the revealed truth, the revelation of God, and the doctrine of the Word of God. And it even gets into the churches and so on. Then more blatant attacks, then the rise of science and the seizing hold of science by Satan, to deploy it, if he can, to deceive minds and suggest rational explanations for being and for life and for existence. And all the time, it's words. So the little horn is little only if judged militarily, because now Satan has switched to words. During the time of the 4 major world empires, including Rome, the world was polytheistic. And actually, the true God was not so much opposed, but just counted one mere God among many. And we saw it with Babylon. The whole genus of Babylon, you didn't oppose the gods of the nations you took over. You recognized them. Yours was just the superior one, but you would allow them to keep them. Polytheism is quite happy to recognize every nation's gods. But once polytheism tumbled, then, of course, the true God is being proclaimed, then opposition to the true church switches entirely to words. Pollute the doctrines. Oppose the doctrines. Oppose revealed truth. Tear it down. So the little horn, judged militarily, is smaller than the others. But in terms of its influence and power, it's far greater. And that is the little horn which arises in the period after Rome, the period of the church. The Antichrist comes. But this 21st verse, which on the surface is so depressing, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Well, Antichrist does prevail. Look at our nation. We are all third-rate citizens. Here we are in a minority, fighting to get our word out, unrecognised, suppressed where possible. The mighty broadcasting authorities won't let us in. Nobody will let us into the marketplace of the world today. The Antichrist has blinded everybody's mind, and we are suppressed. However, by the power of the Spirit, we witness and we preach the gospel, and God continues to save his elect. But just judged on a superficial level, we are a repressed community, the true church, the proclaimers of the gospel. And so it is through the gospel age. There are times when God makes bare his arm. There are times like the mighty Reformation, when just a handful of monks who left the Church of Rome and rebelled against her tyranny were able to spread the light of the gospel through the entire civilized world in their day, mightily, and push back all the superstition and the Romanism and the nonsense and the darkness and ignorance spiritually. But there are times of triumph for us. There are times of awakening. We've had them in this country when thousands upon thousands, even millions, have been converted. And it's made a tremendous impression upon the whole land. And even governments have had to pause and take their breath and respect the gospel of Christ. And we've had mighty awakenings in the 18th century, in the 19th century. And think of these even in Victorian times and late Victorian times. Huge numbers of Christian believers. But then Satan and Antichrist strike back, and the rise of Darwinism and so on. You know the story and how these things are thrust back. By and large, through the gospel age, we see the triumph of Christ in the conversion of millions of individuals. But you look at nations, look above that at whole countries, and you find the work of repression of the church. And that's verse 21. Prevailed against them. Apart from those seasons that God gives, the churches in nations will be the underdogs. Until, verse 22, the end of the period of the gospel, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. And in just a few words, you've covered there the return of Christ, the day of judgment, the marriage supper of the Lamb, the ushering in of the eternal glory, all just summarized. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth before the Saviour comes. See, there's little differentiation between his first coming and his second coming in Daniel 7. And this fourth beast shall be diverse from all kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth and tread it down and break it in pieces. Well, that refers clearly to the little horn which comes out of the fourth beast. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise. Well, maybe all the nation states, including ours now today. And another shall rise after them, or with them, you could translate, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. It's that little horn. And he shall, verse 25, shall speak great words against the Most High. We see the climax of this with the great campaign of scientific humanism against truth. He shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out or wear down the saints of the Most High. Does wear us down in many ways. And think to change times and laws. Some people say, oh, he'll only think to do it. He won't succeed. But think to change times and laws means much more, that times and laws will be changed by Antichrist after a long thinking period and period of campaign. Well, we see that today. And we see moral laws being overturned. And we see the stamping out of the memory of anything Christian. Think of the things that have been organized and held where all reference to any Christian heritage and history has to be airbrushed out today and done away with. All the well-changed times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. But back to the courtroom in verse 26, we've almost come to conclusion. But the judgment shall sit. There will be that great judgment referred to earlier. And they shall take away his dominion, the little horn, to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations, my thoughts much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me. My pallor, my colour, everything changed. But I kept the matter in my heart. Why was Daniel so disturbed? It is, after all, a revealing of the great sovereignty of God. The period of world empires will come to an end. There'll be another period in which Gentiles will be saved. There are encouraging things here. There'll be a final end when God will judge and suppress all that is against him, and the arrogant voice will be silenced, and the eternal age will be brought in. But it's very troubling to Daniel. I'm sure he'll rejoice at those things in due time. But to think that there must be so much pain, to see the human heart so full of continuing rebellion, to see such hatred for a precious revelation from God, for the Son of Man, such resistance to his work, that's what troubles Daniel. To see that there are going to be yet centuries of human hostility to God before the final end. But that chapter, if we can have it in our minds, that chapter is an essential foundation for the revelations which follow, which fill in much detail and tell us wonderful things. That's why I'm not attempting application tonight. Just to get the picture in mind, and the four empires, and the hint of a gospel age in this chapter. Though it's right that Daniel sees the two comings of Christ as if they're one. Not that he's misled, he's just shown the Redeemer in the future. We're going to see more about Christ on Calvary in a coming vision. But he's just shown that Messiah is going to come and solve everything and usher in the eternal age. The division of his coming waits for the New Testament. But I hope this will be of help so that we have a foundation and a background for the rest of the book. Let's close our thinking this evening, friends, singing the hymn 542. Hymn number 542. Leave God to order.